Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah will take place May 19th through the 21st, 2017 at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information. Wargaming Recon is made possible by listeners like you. Become a Patreon backer to get behind-the-scenes content and new episodes before everyone else, starting at $1 per month. Visit wargamingrecon.com/Patreon to become a Patreon backer.
Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the TSR Podcast Network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 170, Crafting a Homebrew Game. If you're a longtime or new listener, you should know one thing. I'm going to talk about a lot of things in this episode, but you don't have to remember them all because we have the show notes. That's right. You just have to remember one thing, one simple thing, the link to the show notes. That is wargamingrecon.com/WR170. That's wargamingrecon.com/WR170. So you might have intuited by the fact that I'm not introducing a certain someone right now, that I don't have my co-host Mike Payne with me. I'm recording this on a Saturday, and he's out in Western Massachusetts at the Fort Devens Museum Game Day, and he's, I'm sure, having a blast there. Some of you might be there as well, and you might be listening to this after the fact. I hope people who aren't there get a chance to go because it's supposed to be a lot of fun. But I do have a treat for you. This episode isn't just going to be me talking because that gets boring, right? I got a very special guest with me. He's a local buddy of mine who's created this really cool dungeon crawl homebrew game. He uses minis, and it's in the style, in my mind, of like those old school RPG dungeon crawls. So he's coming on, actually, as soon as I get done talking and introducing him, he's going to be here right here with us and talking about how he does this and how you can do it and the who's and the whys and the hows and all that kind of stuff. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be really interesting. So I want to go ahead right now and introduce the one and the only Mr. Alex Kostopoulos. Alex, how are you today?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I say this every episode, so people are probably like, dude, you say it every episode and it doesn't count. But it's true. I'm very excited for this episode and to talk with you about this.
You maintain a very high level of excitement in your day to day. So I believe it. You're always excited.
Sure. We'll go with that. You should see me first thing in the morning, because I tell you, when my daughter wakes up and it's like 6:30 and you hear, wah, and I'm like, oh God, I don't want to get up. And my eyes are like, and until we get some fluids in us and start moving around, things just, it's not pretty.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, that's what little kids will do to you. You know, I have one of my own, and we're going through a phase right now where it's a lot of 2 in the mornings, 2:30, 2 in the morning. Yeah. For no good reason. Just can't sleep anymore. In fact, I get the knock on the door. Daddy. Yep. I have to tell you something. What? I can't sleep. No kidding. And that's sort of been the routine for the past week or so. So I'm running on fumes myself.
Oh, that's terrible. With us, we've had, it's not that bad, thank God, because she's in a crib, but she'll wake up in the middle of the night and she'll cry out and we can't figure out what it is. She kind of has a little bit of sniffles and we don't know, is it a cold or what the heck's going on? Because I know at around her age, they start to have nightmares, which kind of makes me sad that a baby's having nightmares. Well, I guess a toddler is what I should refer to it. But so I don't know what the hell it is, but she cries out in the middle of the night. It's like, I don't know, midnight or 1 o'clock, and you hear it. And you think, oh man, just go back to sleep.
Yep.
I don't want to have to come in. And I don't, maybe that makes me an awful dad. I don't really know, but I hope not. It's just like, give me 5 hours of sleep, okay?
No, I think it makes you a parent, just like every other parent. I think everyone's hoping that the kid goes back to sleep. But of course, you'll be there if you need to.
Unlike my wife, I can sleep through just about anything. I've been known, I actually once slept through a fire. I was at a hotel, the hotel was on fire. I was sleeping through it. They had to come and get the fire department in and like wake me up and drag me out. So I can sleep through anything. Whereas my wife, even if our daughter's fine, the fact that she woke up and was crying, my wife can't sleep the rest of the night. So she'll be awake and she might be in bed, or she might get up and like go and lay on the couch just in case. And I kind of just figure, I think it's a genetic thing. Women are engineered to respond more quickly to these kind of sounds, and that probably makes me sexist, but I think there's actual scientific proof behind it, whereas at least with me, I am not, and so I'll go right back to sleep. But if she needs me, then I'll be there. Otherwise, you know, dead to the world.
Sure, sure. And I can say that it's fortunate that you married who you did, so that if your house does catch on fire or anything else horrible like that, at least we know somebody will have things, you know, under control.
Well, I tell you, it won't be me, that's for sure. So let's talk about your game. I know it, when I first talked to you about coming on and doing this, one of the things you said was, oh, I guess I got to name it now. Have you made any progress on that front?
I have not. I really, I'll put this out to the internet land. Once you hear about this, if you have ideas, feel free to contact John or myself, I guess, in some way, shape, or form with ideas for names, because I got nothing. I like designing it. I am not a namer of things.
I can respect that. It always takes me forever to kind of come up with an episode name. So I'll be sitting here in just hour after hour thinking, what should I call this thing? What'll be catchy? What'll be interesting to people? What kind of defines what it is? And it's not easy, I tell you.
No, it's not. You put so much into thinking of the rules and the finite mechanics of everything. It's just, for me, I don't know, it's the last thing that I'll ever think of, because there's so much tuning and playtesting to do. It's just the last thing I would worry about.
Well, why don't you tell the listeners what this game is, what you've been working on?
Sure. So I guess the best way to say this is, as you did mention, it's sort of in the vein of an old school dungeon crawl. I am a very big fan of the old video game and, well, pretty much any iteration of it, of Gauntlet. So this is sort of the same idea. You control any number of characters. You know, they're nameless characters. You can, of course, name them if you wish, but it's the idea of controlling an individual through sort of a cinematic set of combat where you're fighting that one against many, fighting your hordes of enemies, and you kill these minions, and eventually, you know, a lieutenant will spawn, work your way through to the boss, and sort of get into completion through that. Through that, you have, you know, you get gold and you upgrade your character as you play. It's sort of, I feel like I am straddling the line between RPG and war game with it. I hope, anyway. That's kind of my intention.
Well, in playing it, it feels like a really good tabletop skirmish game. And I like that you have some of these extra elements to it, so that it's not just you come in and you kill everyone, which is, I mean, many a good game has been that. You play Frag, I think, and Frag, great board game. You go in and just who can kill the most people, and that's cool. And I played other mini like pulp games, Mike Payne's game, which you really have to play should you make it to TotalCon, and I hope you do. Again, it's basically whoever kills the most of your opponents can have a lot of fun that way. But I like when there's a little something extra, a little twist to it. And you've done that. I mean, you mentioned about being able to buy upgrades and stuff, but there's one specific twist that I really like, and that's your quest feature.
Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit about what the quest is and why you added them in? I think that's an interesting little bit.
Sure. So questing in the game, as I've already kind of explained, the overarching idea is kill the boss, you know, clear all the enemies from the board. And of course, that can be done, and you can sort of play that in a very basic way. But I got to thinking that when you play a MMO or any video game, there's always side quests. So this game needed side quests. And I made the decision that there are these little search nodes where if you search them, you have about a third of the time you should roll a quest. And they're everything from, you know, kill five of a minion type that might be in the game to more typical wargaming objectives, sort of defend a node, or capture a node, escort quests, that sort of idea. Some other things that I'm sort of working on fine tuning and throwing in there, maybe even a little bit of a gambling situation put in there between you and a deity. So some ideas to give the game flavor, but also provide depth to the game, I think. And the other thing is that it's sort of the extended mechanic of the game. So when you play the game, you know, all your stats will reset from game to game, with the exception of the currency that you collect from quests. If you do quests, you get this currency. And if you collect, let's say, 3 or 5 of them, you can buy your character a permanent power. Maybe it's to lay a wall down once per game. Maybe it gives you a reroll. Maybe it gives you some other interesting power, like a fireball or something like that, to use. So it's a way of actually developing your characters as well as, you know, sort of just hack and slashing your way through it.
So I've had limited experience with the quests. I think we only played it the last time you and I playtested the game. We used the quests, and they were interesting. I like that it's not just like go and get this item or go here, or like you said, just go kill some people. You have some of that variety where that the gambling with the deed eat one sounds fascinating, because it could be really good or it could be really bad. And I think each quest, you never really know if it's going to be ideal when you're playing, because it depends on the situation you're in. So you have a little bit of uncertainty, and it allows people with different playing styles to get different positives out of the game, which is a really cool aspect as well.
Yeah. The other thing with quests, and I think you and I kind of ran into this when we play tested, is you may not succeed in a quest if you do not have enough people. The odds, the one that we did was defend a node, and the odds were just stacked against us because we played with 2 characters. And there was the situation was bad. The location that we picked, was in a bad spot on the board. There were too many respawns coming, and it just was not something that we were going to obtain. So we sort of said, okay, forget that side objective. Let's work on something else and see what we can get here. But then, you know, earlier this week, and, I got the, you know, kill 5 goblins and succeeded it, and it was we succeeded doing it and got the little bonus and all that stuff. And in fact, actually, we came up with the idea that to add to that, when you complete your quest, not only would you get that currency, but you also get 1 reroll, a free reroll, as a, you know, sort of like an added bonus, which tipped the scales of the game. We were going to lose, and that 1 reroll ended up being the thing that that turned it around for us, interestingly.
Why did you end up going with a dungeon crawl mechanic instead of, say, strictly an RPG or strictly like a tabletop war game with minis? Like you said, you're kind of on the fence of all of these.
Yeah, it's sort of how I've been brought up in gaming. I've always played RPGs. I really like war games. And, you know, if I could take a step back, when I wanted to design this in general, I sort of had 3 ideas in my head. The first was I wanted to make it quick and easy. You know, there's a time and place for complex games, and that time and place is not to be written by someone who's writing their first set of rules. So something simple, something fun. I mean, that's one of the other big things, especially when you're playtesting, make sure that it's fun. The other idea that I had was I wanted to use very few miniatures. The idea around that was that I have a decent collection. A lot of them are fantasy miniatures. But I always think about people who don't have that many miniatures and they want to get into miniature gaming, or they, you know, maybe they have a few guys from their RPGs and they're sort of on the fence of wargaming. And I've seen with wargaming, you either jump in 2 feet and buy yourself an army and say, okay, this is what I want to do, or you find some sort of smaller skirmish game, which to a degree, maybe you can get by with fewer guys. But the big kid on the block skirmish games are also pretty large in numbers of guys. So this, I said, okay, I want to make something that probably has no more necessary than 10 guys. And since it's cooperative, you can share the guys. The concept of respawns allows for you to sort of reuse guys that have already died. So that was the other idea that I had going on. But to really answer your original question, I do straddle the line of sort of an RPG and a war game. And I have often felt that war games, while they're awesome and I do love them, I love playing them, oftentimes there's no sense of individuality. And that's where the RPGist in me said, hey, I need to have something where I can play this, a war game set of rules or an idea like this, and have that cinematic experience that you get with wargaming. But I also don't want to play an RPG, because a lot of the times when you play an RPG, solutions are out of the box and you no longer have to follow a strict wargaming rule set of conflict resolution. A lot of times you can say, the orcs are attacking. Well, I want to light the building on fire and create a diversion, or light the building on fire because they're in the building and light all the orcs on fire. So I wanted to avoid that and create strict, dice-driven combat. And I really didn't see much else out there other than, actual D&D board games, that sort of thing. Maybe Descent is another board game. And that sort of, I guess maybe this is my fourth tenet of gaming, was I do not want to game on cardboard. There's nothing against it for people who like that. I love board games. But when I play a miniature game, I like to have my table looking as fantastic as I can possibly make it. And I do feel I do a decent job of that, if I may toot my own horn. I don't necessarily want cardboard chits or a cardboard-looking dungeon printout, that sort of thing, or especially not like a whiteboard. That's great for an RPG, but not for what I was trying to do.
In some ways, it's kind of like the game that you've created is a light or intro style of something like Mordheim.
Yeah, I would say I think I could agree with that for sure. I've told you this. One of my favorite systems is Song of Blades and Heroes, which is a very small independent skirmish game, allowing you to use any miniatures in your collection. You don't need to buy a specific line or anything like that. In fact, they encourage you to sort of mix and match as you see fit. I was really, really inspired by that idea. And there is a lot, there's Mordheim. Frostgrave now is another sort of getting the mantle of the new Mordheim. And I really am inspired by those kind of games. I really enjoy Mordheim. So yeah, I think this is sort of a light version of that sort of thing.
This is perhaps a little off topic, but do you think Frostgrave will continue its ascent of popularity with Specialist Games coming back for Games Workshop with a lot of support, and they're reissuing all the games, and presumably Mordheim will be one of them, and Necromunda and all that kind of stuff?
I hope so. I think it's going to be tough. If again, it's usually if that big kid on the block decides that they're going to do something, the littler guys tend to have a tougher time. I think that it's really up to the consumer, what they want to put in. I hope that hobby stores are supporting games like Frostgrave and not just GW all the time. Not that I have anything, I don't have a beef with them or anything like that.
I do.
I know. Because I think they make great stuff. I think it's a little on the expensive side, but you're also getting some really good quality. Around our area, there's select places that play non-Guild Wars. Guild Wars, GW. Bringing myself back to a few years to my old Guild War days. And then you have X-Wing and stuff like that. Those mainstream ones they're a lot of fun. Really do hope that something like Frostgrave can continue. The thing that they have going for them is that all they need to do is put out rule books. They're not looking to, they do have miniature lines, but they're not looking to take over the miniature market. They're doing sort of what Osprey does and say, hey, here's a new set of rules. Do you like them? Great. If not, we'll churn out another one in another 3 months.
I can tell you, for anyone who's interested in playing Frostgrave, who lives within Eastern Massachusetts, that a buddy of mine who you'll end up meeting at some point, I'm sure, his name is Adam. He's going to be running Frostgrave at TotalCon. He's actually running it as we record at the Fort Devens game day, but he's a big proponent of it. And he's been trying to get me into it for a long time because he thinks it's a kind of game that would really fit my style of play. So he's always like, oh, you gotta play this, I gotta teach you how to play this. And so he's gonna be running it, I don't have the official time or any of that kind of stuff, but he'll be running it at TotalCon. I think it's probably the Saturday or the Sunday of TotalCon, probably in the morning or something like that, so people can get a chance of playing it. And I know wherever you're at, a lot of game stores, like you said, they do try these other games, but depending on the type of game store, unfortunately, I think a lot of them end up having to come back to what's going to bring them the most money. And that ends up being Magic the Gathering, any of those CCG kind of things. And if they're doing any sort of minis, it's Games Workshop. And if they stretch, they might do Privateer Press. And if they really stretch, they might do Battlefront stuff.
Sure.
But beyond that, they just, most of them, they don't, partly because they can't. They don't have the room to stock all of it. And for every one person like you or me who's really into the historicals or the other stuff, it's like 50 or 100 people who are going to play Magic. And they're going to buy, you know, $100 boxes, five, six of them at a time whenever a new set comes out. And usually historical guys don't need that much kind of stuff.
We're
not going to pay that kind of thing, you know, for that. So it's tricky for them, and I understand, but at the same time, it's a little disheartening that there's not as much of a groundswell for those type of businesses.
Yeah, you know, it's a really good point. And I think that it's one of those things that you as the community needs to, everyone needs to just sort of run their own game. And I know that that's a tall order, but if you're passionate for a game, you're doing the community a great service by saying, hey, let me show you guys how to play this game just on a random Saturday in a game store. And because let me tell you, when you're play testing something, even like I'm doing, it's very, very difficult to get people to sit down and say, hey, I'll give you my time to try this, especially when, you know, they maybe get out to a game store once a week and they want to play what they want to play. You know, they want to get down and play their Magic or whatever it is that they're into. So the more things like this are around and the more people get exposed to a Frostgrave or any sort of non big kid on the block sort of game, I think it really only helps those of us who love miniature games and war games in general.
So when you made the decision that, hey, you wanted to go ahead and create your game, what kind of caused that? What was the, you know, the thing that pushed you over the edge to say, oh, you know, I have this idea, let me actually try to implement it and do something with it?
You have to be a crazy person, I think. You have to have a few screws loose to want to do this for a few reasons. I've always tinkered with game design just on my own, with no real intention to do anything with it. To actually write stuff down and take it to the point where you want to play test it, you have to be a little insane, and you have to get over very quickly the fact that people will either not like it, or B, try to tell you how you could have made it so much better, you know, according to their own brain. Which is really funny to hear sometimes, because I think everyone says it in a very well-meaning way, but you do get a lot of, oh, you know, it'd be cool is if you totally rewrote this and, you know, had every other mechanic that I'm suggesting besides the one you've picked. and, you know, everyone has a game in their heart, I think, that they want to put out.
I could just say that I've only had a limited experience of your game and playing it and talking with you about it. But in my very limited experience, I think not a moment's gone by where someone hasn't come over and been like, oh, this looks really cool, but, and then they spend like 20 minutes talking about how you should change every single thing about your game. But you should keep the minis because those are cool.
Exactly.
That, let's swap it all out and do what I really think you should do.
Yeah, it's, everyone wants in their heart, if you play a game, I think you've given some thought to how to make it, how you could have made it better, you know, in a video game, or heck, I'm sure somebody somewhere is like, I could write checkers so much better, or if chess had five guys playing rather than two. Somebody always has a suggestion as to how to improve, and you have to just kind of take it at face value and realize that if people are having fun, that's your primary objective. And I'm not here to make millions of dollars off of a miniature rule set where, quite frankly, you know, these concepts are not even concepts that I've invented. They're the concepts that I've used from other games. I mean, I'm not a military war game genius. I've just taken ideas that work from other games and sort of applied them differently. I'm not looking to make a buck off of it. In fact, if and when the time comes where it's published, it's going to be free and people can just pick it up and play it and enjoy it.
Way, way back on, I don't know, 6-7 years ago on the show, I talked about, you know, making this transition from the whole, what I call the GW metric, and going into historicals and how open and confusing all that is. And one of the things I discussed was that in the historical rule sets that I came across, it became very apparent very quickly that it was kind of expected that the player was going to tweak things, that they're going to just change all paragraphs, get rid of stuff, redo, and that some of those rules encourage you to do it. Black Powder being one that comes to mind first, because they have like a whole section on it, like, please change it because this is what works for us. And GW and some of the other games, they'll have like a thing in there. If this doesn't work, roll the dice or whatever, but that's not the same. I think outside of this whole really community of people who do historical type war games, those who do, say, sci-fi or do, I'm going to pick on GW again, but GW or Private Oppressor or any of that kind of stuff, I think by and large, an accurate statement would be that people who play those and people who design those have this expectation that the rule is a rule is a rule. So if it's written, you got to go by that. You got to do whatever it says, whether it makes sense or not. And if it doesn't make sense, you might do something differently, but that's not legit. So you then have to go get the company or the game designer to say, yes, that was okay, or no, yeah, it's not. And whereas with historicals, people are going to be like, well, the game designer is wrong. They don't know anything. They're not an expert. Do they have 5 PhDs on this 10 minutes of battle? No, they do not. So therefore, let me fix it because I know better than they do. And sometimes they do. And so they fix it and then they do the homebrew stuff with it. And it's great. And other times it's not so much. And it's just, it's interesting because I think these two different camps really are different in some ways. And this being one of them, in other ways, they're so similar, almost as if they were one camp and just kind of someone's hanging out in a different room in a house. But on this thing, I think the fact that you have that background of being a war gamer, historical war gamer, when you kind of dived into this, you having that openness was good because someone else would not. They'd be like, well, this is what I wrote. And yeah, you can play test it. And I'm curious if you think the mechanic works, but I don't really want to know anything about what you have to say about anything, because really this is what I wrote. And so you should go publish your own rule set otherwise. That's rude. But I think it shows the two different dynamics here.
There's so much behind what you just said there. And it just triggered like a lot of thoughts in my head. First of all, I think,
have at it.
Yeah. So first of all, I think you have to consider who is writing a game like a GW game, Hordes or War Machine game. And typically it's a company that has a team of people, especially in the case of GW. And again, this is also like a D&D thing too, where you have a team of people who are like developing the laws of this, you know, whereas in a lot of times in a historical or even a game like Frostgrave, it's like a dude just sitting there banging it out, you know, and hoping that somebody gets some pictures that look cool for his book. And, you know, some of these guys, yes, they're obviously commissioned by Osprey or whatever, but it's usually a guy who's trying to think of every single possible permutation of what could happen and try to cram it into a rule set. And you have to turn around and say, well, you know what, this is what I see, but please take it and run with it. So I think you got that. I think you also have a need to have very, very defined rules when it comes to the tournament. And you and I've talked a little bit about this offline, obviously. You know, the tournament players, they need rules. They need really hard and fast rules where the law is the law, because when it comes time to compete, you can't have some sort of, you know, wishy-washy, well, you know, you moved your guy this and that's not really exactly right. So you can't have that. You know, you need to have some sort of a direct, this is what the rule book says and this is how we're going to play this. But, you know, again, as a designer, in some ways, giving the players liberty to do stuff with the game is a very nice, cheap, and easy way out of things. Especially so, you know, we've had discussion around monsters or enemies in my game and their motivation or what they would do or how to play them. And I've come to the conclusion very recently that I do not care. I will not write anything on that because I think it is up to the players to move the monsters in the way they see fit. And if they want to make them run like cowards, go ahead, have at it. I mean, if that's what you're going to have out of a fun game, I think that everybody who is ever going to touch my rules will be smart enough to know that the monsters should, you know, get in a position to make the best possible attack. And if you can't, you know, and you figure that out to the best of your ability, and maybe I'll put in a few guidelines, but there's no way I want to put in AI as we've sort of talked about. It's just, it's a lot of work, first of all. And I don't think that it's worth the return. I think it should be left up to a game master or, you know, in my game, it's, you could play cooperatively and run the monsters cooperatively, which we've done. And we seem to come up with great ideas as to what the monsters should do. So anyway, that's my spiel on your take on the adding things into games and the concept of, you know, team design and that sort of thing. I went off on a tangent.
No, tangent is good. And it's, I find it interesting and enjoyable at the same time that you don't want to dictate how people should have the monsters behave. So for listeners who never experienced your game, but we played a few times, and in those, there have been some dilemmas as to which way would a monster go. Would the monster go to try to attack and potentially kill the closest opponent, or would it try to go and get someone else who's also nearby who's trying to complete a quest? Which means more to the monster or the evil side or the, you know, the GM side, and where should they really go? And I think the common sense kind of thing for how most people would handle it is, like you said, they want to have a level of priorities, and it might not be, you know, written down or whatever, but they want to go with which is going to cause the most threat to them. So will actually completing that objective push the players any closer to winning the game? If so, then they should respond to that. And if not, then they shouldn't. And that's kind of a gut call, which I think comes back to your D&D or your role-playing game background. Because as a GM, I mean, there's a reason why a lot of GMs use those GM screens when they're doing a game like that. It's because, you know, they might have something in mind, and maybe they roll the dice, and the dice actually gives a result of what's supposed to happen. But maybe that's not what is in the best interest of the gamer or of that session. And so they're going to change it. And they'll make it be whatever they want, and the shield protects them, so that way players aren't supposed to look behind it. They're not supposed to know what really is. They're just supposed to go along with the presumption that the GM, the umpire, is doing what is going to create the best environment for them or the best story for what's going on. Sometimes I think you can get into a lot of trouble, though, with house ruling things. And I think a house rule is perfectly fine for a game if you are playing in a same location or with the same group of people, or if it's like a common enough house rule that it's kind of an unofficial errated rule for a system. But I've actually experienced, and it doesn't annoy me, it's just it's confusing because sometimes people think a house rule is a real rule when it's not. I've experienced some games at conventions or games that may have been done as attorney where I wasn't playing an attorney, but I played it elsewise. And you see that they're playing something and they just kind of expect that everyone knows that they're playing it a certain way. And everyone thinks, well, that's how you play. And as a new player, that's confusing because that's not how you play. And you can play that way and it's okay. But the house rule shouldn't replace the rule as a standard for, especially just for new people, because it's confusing. They get the rule book and they think, what the heck? Am I doing it wrong? What's going on? So I think if you're having an alteration like that, it's important for it to be kind of stated or made apparent to people and say, you know, this is how we like to do it. So this makes the most sense to us. This is what we want to do. And so you have it there in writing or you verbalize it or whatever. Because otherwise people think, well, that's the rule. And I've actually had for a specific rule system where I learned it, and I learned it through a house rule. And the house rule is fine. I mean, maybe it enhances or makes the rules better. I don't know. But then other people thought that was a real rule. So they've come and they played games with me, or I've seen them play games elsewhere, and then it keeps on. It's like a game of telephone. It keeps on getting further and further away from what the reality is. And you want to change the reality, fine, but I think it needs to be noted as such for people. So if you, in your game, Alex, were like, hey, I think monsters need to behave this way, and you line it all out and spell out the whole AI and everything, and a GM sees that, and they're like, you know, I don't want to do that. And then they alter it. I think that's when the problem can happen. Because they alter it and someone else thinks that's how it's supposed to be. And then they teach someone else and it's wrong. And no one ever really looks at the rules, or they think that your rules are wrong. Well, that guy, he got it wrong. It's published, but that's not the real thing, because that's not how I was taught. So I think by leaving it open, it's very easy for people to realize that they get to use their best judgment, whatever that is, and that there's no hard and fast rule for it. So therefore, you just kind of avoid the whole problem whatsoever. And it makes it easier, I think, for new players.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't see the point in pushing people to run. So again, my point is if you want to play this cooperatively, right, the way we tend to do it, we run the monsters and we are kind of playing the heroes and we sort of also run the monsters. So we as a team are sort of discussing how we want to do this. Generally speaking, we'll move monsters into a position where they, if they can hit either of us, they will be in that position to hit either of us. We roll to see who they will target. So we randomize that as much as possible. And the other opportunity, the other way to play this is you have a bunch of players who play the heroes, and then there's one person kind of running the monsters. And if that's the case, then all bets are off. The guy's trying to kill you anyway. So, I mean, you might as well, you know, let him do what he's going to do. And it's really just a question in my setup anyways of where you're going to move the guy. Like, you know, who cares? The combat is resolved so easily that there's not going to be much of a debate on that stuff. It's just a question of, am I going to move the zombie intelligently and, you know, have him, you know, maybe obstruct a objective, or is he just going to shamble on like a zombie would and go to the first thing that's there? And I just think that that's something that, you know, why write that? Just let somebody make that somebody else's problem.
We've been talking a little bit about your process, in particular with the monsters and how they are supposed to behave. How else have you kind of approached the game? Like, after you were crazy and you jumped off the cliff, where did you kind of begin and how have you gone along and what steps have you taken to really go from that concept to where you are now? And what kind of steps do you think you'll have to take to go from the present to a finished product?
So from inception, sort of the biggest jump, I think, was character design. Because that started to become, so class design, I should say, really not character design. Because again, I'm not really rewriting the book of war games. I mean, you move X number of inches, you know, and you have a run that doubles that move. So you move 4 inches, you can run 8. Mechanics are sort of a dice pool mechanic, but it's a very, very small dice pool, as you know. Most dice pools are about 2, maybe 3 dice, and you're just taking the highest value of that pool on a D6, and comparing it against somebody else's. So mechanic wise, it did take me a little while to decide that stuff, but I settled on it pretty quickly and knew that I wasn't going to try to, at least for my first attempt at writing something, not rewrite the whole book on that. Where it did get difficult, and that next, like that natural big jump was designing characters that were fun. Or classes, I keep saying characters, but I do mean classes, that were fun, that played differently, that made sense. And of course, balancing them, which is still sort of an ongoing thing. You had seen actually some of the very early ideas. And then you've seen some of the newer concepts of the classes and how each one kind of plays differently. So that was a very big jump for me. And one that I spent a lot of hours on, believe it or not, because it's just, you know, that's where the meat and potatoes is. Everything else is sort of just dice rolling. And not to make that sound like that doesn't matter, but there's so many different dice rolling mechanics that are out there that you can adapt and borrow and sort of kind of take from. And again, you know, things like broken terrain, generally everybody knows you're going to move half your speed, in most cases. Cover, you know, it's a very simple concept of there's some sort of a bonus applied or a negative given in some sort of way. So you just sort of fit that in. But developing a cohesive system where the classes hung together and played differently was very, very tough. But to answer your other question as to where to go from here, I definitely need to finish up the sort of the treasure list of quest things you can purchase from your quest currency, which is very sadly the best term I've come up with so far is heroic medallion as the currency. So again, if anyone has any great ideas, let me know. So I have to finish up that list because now I've had people actually complete quests and sort of want to see that next level, be able to buy things. And then I think it's more or less finishing touch time. I'd like to start to run this at either conventions or on a regular game store night to see if I can get people to really get into it. And then, you know, like I said, I'll probably just put it out there. I doubt that I'm going to try to make a buck off of it. It sounds, I don't have any artistic ability when it comes to designing pictures. So it's a very plain looking PDF. If any artists want to volunteer to draw me some amazing barbarian pictures and whatnot, that'd be fantastic. But, you know, I don't have any publishing knowledge. I probably would just either put it out on, you know, something like, one of those RPG or war game, websites, you know, help me out here, host.
Well, I was going to say, you might not be aware, maybe a lot of people aren't aware, but Ben Gerber, who's a game designer, and he has, and of course I can't reach it because it's just out of reach. And he just finished a Kickstarter for two games, actually, one Swamped and one's, Ninja, Silent But Deadly. He started off doing games where, for his artwork, he would go and get free clip art. And there's a lot of that available on the net because, again, he's not someone who's graphically talented in that way, but publish them and puts them up online. And I mean, he's an industry guest for TotalCon and Head Honcho, the Troll in the Corner. And he puts them on like RPG Now and DriveThruRPG.
That's the one I was thinking of too. Yeah.
Yeah. I have stuff up on Wargame Vault, episodes of the show, and there are some print products. And one of the cool things that they're doing is if you're like me and you just kind of want a free exchange of ideas, but you don't want to turn down a little bit of money if someone wants to toss it to you, they have a new feature, or new-ish, I guess it's probably been around a couple of years. It's called Pay What You Want.
Sure.
You mark a product, pay what you want, and you put your game up, and I come along and go, oh, this looks cool. Let me get. And, you know, I think it's probably worth, you look at the preview and think, oh, it's worth a couple bucks. I'll put $2 in. And so then I pay $2, and someone else will be like, this is worth a lot of money. And they give you $20. Someone says, you know, I can't afford, or I don't want, or whatever, and they get it for free, but that's okay. And you get a little something and kind of leave it up. Like a tip jar sort of thing is what I think of it as.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably along the lines of what I'll do. I mean, to me, the biggest honor would be if somebody was like, hey, I played your game and I think it's awesome. And that's all. I mean, I think that's all anybody ever really wants, especially in this sort of market where it's a very small group of people, you know, comparatively to the world for that matter. You know, we're a small group, and you know, you want somebody to say, nice job, you know, and enjoy it and want to play it. That's sort of, I think, the big thing is I would love to bring it to a game store and have people be psyched to be part of it. You know, our friend John, who does the zombie crawl, mm-hmm. people are psyched for that. And, he's not so much writing his own rules, but he's putting together this amazing atmospheric thing based on Necromunda, which he does alter a little bit. And people just really, really look forward to it. And if I could get that same level of interest for my own personal rule set, that's really all I would ask for.
See, I want to be a billionaire. All the money in the world. That's what I want. No, not really.
Well, I mean, that would be great too. I could promise you a sequel. I could promise you a sequel if I was a billionaire.
It'll be three-part trilogies here.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'll add another saga to it, and we'll take one of the games and turn it into a special, like, 3 or 4 parts, kind of like they did with The Hobbit, and just get extra content out of that movie adaptation and sell the rights for big money.
May I say something blasphemous and off topic?
And please do. I have to say, though, I don't want to. I mean, I'm not going to turn down money, but I don't want to be a billionaire. That's not why I'm doing this.
Nice.
I am completely of sound mind and knowing. It's not going to happen from this anyway. So go ahead.
I like how you needed to save face right there first.
Well, I mean, I like to think if people have been listening for a long time, they understand and they get me. But you never know. This could be someone who's turning on for the first time and they think, wow, what an ass. He really wants all my money from this? What a jerk. I'm not listening to this guy anymore.
Listen, I know this guy personally, everyone. He is an ass, honestly.
See, I'm telling you. The truth is coming out.
No, he's one of the nicest guys I know.
He's very passionate about your eyes.
Yeah, he's very passionate about the hobby, and he's a good guy. My blasphemous comment was that I wish that they would take The Hobbit and or anything Middle Earth, and they would just continue to churn out movies. And I'm probably the only person who feels that way, but I just enjoy them, and I don't really care anymore whether or not it's following lore or not. I think they should just go the crazy money grab way and just keep giving me big cinematic elves and dwarves and all that other good stuff, because I love it, and I will pay good money for that at all times.
I was annoyed, actually, when I first heard that they're turning it into three movies, because I was like, really?
I was too, initially.
Like 50 pages, not really 50, but I'm like, it's like 50 pages. So how?
Yeah, it's not a big book. Yeah.
But then I realized what they were doing, and this was brilliant, because Peter Jackson's no fool, and this is pertinent, and we'll get to why in a second. But he's no fool, not just because, hey, more money would be nice, and the fact that he actually didn't get much money from Lord of the Rings because Newland screwed him over, and he had to sue them to get his money. But also because he realized he's probably never going to be able to go back to Middle-earth. And so he wanted to be able to tell as much of the story of Middle-earth, its history, the lore, and the characters as possible. And so that's why the movies just aren't focused only on The Hobbit. It's branded as such. But he actually digs back into The Lost Tales and other stuff before sure. to kind of expand on it. And I know not everyone's read all of that. And I mean, I haven't, because I love the movies and the stories are beautifully written. But it's like reading Dickens, okay? And as someone who was a history major, I'm supposed to love Dickens, but I tell you, I can't stand it because I don't need to hear 50 pages worth of content where someone's writing about what a rock looks like.
Dickens got paid by the word, you know that, right?
Yeah, and we live in a different time and place where
yeah, sure.
I have TV and internet and all this kind of stuff. And back then it would have been great because you can't and wouldn't have been able to go to wherever. So you needed these immensely descriptive passages to help you visualize stuff because people, I guess you did, is just what it is. And nowadays we don't, because if we want to know what it looks like on the moon, we go onto our computers or our smartphones or our tablets and we type in the moon and we get pictures of the moon. We get yep. pictures of Pluto, which is now a planet again, which makes me very happy. It's a dwarf planet, but it's a planet. And we can get pictures of Pluto. We can get pictures of the Marianas Trench. We can get pictures of all this stuff. And we can see and we can experience it all, especially now with 3D and Google Cardboard and Oculus Rift and all that kind of thing. You can be there, and you couldn't before, but now you can. So I don't think we have a need for it now. And I think it's partly a generational thing. But I tell you, I don't know if you've seen Alex, but you ever watch, you're probably not a fan of it, and maybe I'm going to alienate half the people. But anyone who's listening to this may have listened to my other show, Geeks Explicitly, and will know I'm a huge fan of Kevin Smith. You ever see the Clerks 2 movie?
Yes, I have. Yep.
So are you familiar with that sequence where Randall is giving his very brief editorialized reenactment of the Lord of the Rings movies?
Yeah, I think I kind of – was that where he was comparing it with whatever other movie was of du jour at the time? It was a Star Wars. It wasn't it Star Wars versus Lord of the Rings at that point?
Well, he's talking to, I think the character's name is Elias. He's one of the cooks. He's a huge nerd and huge geek and very into all this kind of stuff. And he's like, Lord of the Rings, and he has a lot of expletives in it, but he's like, Lord of the Rings are just not that interesting of a story because, you know, they spend like entire books just talking about walking through a field of grass and how it looked and built. And then they stumble. And then, oh, look, the ring, spoiler alert, the ring goes in Mount Doom. And that's it. And I mean, a lot of other innuendo and so forth in his characterization of it. But generally, like, I read Fellowship of the Ring and I thought, this is really interesting and it's cool. And it had that Jaws feeling because the horror and the fright and the worry about what will and will not happen isn't when the ring wraiths are there. It's when you don't see them, but you know something's around. And so that absence of content is really brilliant. And then I got to the Two Towers, and I was like, I'm going to read it before the movie comes out, and I'm reading it during the summer, and I'm like, I just read like 15 chapters where they stood in a field, and they're listening to see if they can hear the orcs run away, and they're like, this blade of grass is really pretty, and oh, this one is too, and by the way, this, and now everyone hates me, but that's how I felt, and at that point, I said, you know what, beautifully written, great story, very talented author with a lot going for him, no doubt that he has had a ton of genius and a huge impact on all that we do. But at the same time, I didn't need to read the books.
Sure. All right. So I'll jump in on this. I think that the appeal is that it's sort of, I'll say the pioneer of its genre. It's not necessarily the best at this point, you know, with you know, decades and decades of more material added. But you have to acknowledge the fact that what it was doing at the time was very groundbreaking. So I don't know. But yes, plot wise, you know, I think there's deeper and more interesting fantasy plots nowadays. So I don't know. But just the same, it's the big kid on the block. You probably changed the title of this podcast to The Big Kid on the Block because I've said it 18 times. And if they made more movies with elves and stuff in it, I would pay money to go see it. I don't really care if it's canon, lore, or whatever you want to call it. I would pay it.
I usually try to steer clear from politics and religion on the show because generally they don't apply. But when it comes to Lord of the Rings, and people may not realize, and if they do, bravo. But for those who don't, Tolkien was a hugely devout Catholic. And so that really helped shape the whole worldview of Middle Earth. And I know people personally are going to argue with me and say that's not true, but it's true. And when you look at it through that lens, it's really interesting to see the choices that were made and the depth that he did put into them and where he didn't and the motivation behind everything. It's a very, very interesting story, not just for it being high fantasy and all that kind of stuff, but also as a religious story. So looking at it that way, and a lot obviously has been written about it from everyone and their brother. But more recently, there's been a lot more articles and books and speeches and stuff looking at it from this Christian lens, which I think is pretty fascinating because I really feel that's how he wanted it to be portrayed. And I mean, we've all heard the story, you know, he's on the front and he had these stories and he wanted to write letters back to his kid and make it interesting. And then they became and so forth, which is true, but many different facets to it, which is, again, goes back to his brilliance. Now, the connection with Peter Jackson to what we're doing here, people may not know, Peter Jackson is a huge war gamer, and maybe people do know, but he has a love of World War I. So he actually commissioned the Perry brothers at one point to make him his own custom World War I figures, and he's helped to create this huge diorama and made some bit of a splash online, I guess, earlier this year. And it's just, he's funded it, he loves it, he's really into all of it, and I mean, not someone people would always think of it as being into it. And you mentioned Star Wars earlier, and the actor who played Grand Moff Tarkin, another huge wargaming fan, and just people pop up all over the place. So it's very interesting in that. To go back to your game, though, you've talked about a little bit some of the difficulties you had in your process and where you expect to go. And it sounds like you're very close to being finished, which is good. But what kind of advice would you have for someone who wants to create their own homebrew game, things that they should really avoid, some pitfalls, some things that have worked really well for you that you would encourage others to kind of tackle or a mindset to use and things of that sort?
Sure. A few things. First of all, get thick skin. You know, I think and really design for fun, like play something you want to play, not something that you think other people want to do. Because I'll tell you, it may sound pathetic, but I play my own game a lot more than I play other games at this point, especially solo, because I just enjoy it that much. You know, it's you put yourself out there, and I guess that's, you know, doing a podcast or anything like that, you're really putting yourself out there. So you really need to love what it is you're doing if you're gonna run that process and put that much time into something. I would also highly recommend that if it's your first time through, do not try to create your own mechanics, borrow, steal, pillage, all those wonderful terms. If you're a genius, that's great. And you want to figure out all these mathematical equations for how to do this. But honestly, dice are dice. You don't need to. I don't think you need to go too crazy with the whole thing. There's always a variation on what already exists and something that will make it yours. I don't know of any war games or very few war games where you can upgrade your guys as you go the way you can in mine. And I am running probably the easiest dice mechanic that you could ever think of, but the turns are very, very fast and the players are always engaged making a movement or a decision or some sort of an attack. So the dice mechanics are very secondary to the actual character playing. So I think that would be my big advice is don't try to spend your time worrying about mechanics and whether or not every little thing is ironed out. That's what playtesting is for. And you'll need to playtest it a lot. I mean, that's probably the biggest problem that I have at this point is I don't know when to say stop with that. You know, when do I say, hey, here, I actually have a game? Or when do I say, hey, I'm playtesting a game?
That's never going to end. Never.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I'm pretty sure that the only difference when I start saying, hey, I have a game, is maybe I'll stop getting people suggesting, hey, that was really cool, but, you know, maybe you could rewrite the entire thing. maybe at that point, they'll accept the fact that I've actually completed
it. I think when you get to a point where you find you're having similar results, where people are consistently, but not always, able to complete the game, and you're happy with the mechanics, I think, or happy enough, I should say. You may never be 100% happy, but like you're 70, 80% happy. I think that's when you can say playtesting is over, the game's done. And you know, maybe you'll always tweak or do a home house rule or something like that, or maybe be like, well, version 2.0 will be, but version 1.0, I think you'll be able to be done probably a lot sooner than you think you'll be.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of crazy. I'm already starting to think of the next project, and it's around the corner. So I think I will probably wrap this up. It'll go into 2017, but I don't think it'll take too much longer before I put a stamp on it and call it done. And again, you know, it's for anyone wanting to do something like this, just like I said, really do what you love to do with it, because you do need to put yourself out there. You're going to take lumps. You're going to have people tell you that it's good, it's not good, it's fun, it's not fun. And, you know, it is worth it, because when you get some feedback where someone says, wow, that was pretty cool. And again, I imagine this is a podcast thing as well. When somebody gives you that positive feedback, it really, really makes it all worthwhile. And it's pretty cool at that point.
Good feedback is always more enjoyed than not good feedback, I guess. But I got to say, I love when someone has criticism that's constructive, because if they're able to spot something, a way to make it better or a way to improve on something, where they're like, you know, what you're doing, and whether it's a podcast or your game or whatever, what you're doing, you have a really good foundation and you can bring it to that next level if you consider such a thing. And when you look at whatever that such a thing is, X, Y, and Z, and you think, you know, they're right. And it can really be so much better, because for me, and I know you feel the same way, it's not about my enjoyment of what's going on here for me. It's what the listeners are getting, what everyone else is having. Is it worth their time? Is it going to be an enjoyable or informative or entertaining experience for them? And you've said that, like, do you want people to have fun playing your game? If they're not having fun, why the heck are they doing it? And so if you can make it more fun, then that kind of feedback is great. And if it's just like, your game's awful, I don't like your game, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
That doesn't help at all, you know?
Yeah. To be fair, there are very few people who have actually turned around and been like, I don't even think there's anybody who's turned around and said, that's awful. There have been the people that, you know, really like to look at the mechanics and think, oh, well, you could do this. And, you know, and then before you know it is, they have a lot of ideas, and then it becomes a rewrite. And you're sort of like, well, thank you, but you know, that's not where I'm going with it. Yeah, it's great. And you know, my final little anecdote, I guess, on the subject is you really need to watch your players, and see what they do. You have to sort of be a detective of sorts when it comes to your players. For example, you, John, are my best example of this, where you played the wizard class in an earlier iteration, and you either didn't know or realized very early on that his special ability was far more powerful than his regular ability, and sort of more all purpose. And that required an immediate redesign, because there was no way. The whole point was that they were supposed to be two separate but equal options. One would be, you know, for using a direct attack, and the other was more for a special situation type attack, or in a case where you thought, hey, maybe this would be a better option, but it was not supposed to replace the other, which you showed me that it was not designed properly. So I went back to the drawing
board. I'm really good at that. To be fair, if there's something where I can find a wiggle room, I'll find it. It doesn't matter how good it is. Like, I'm the one who just, I think differently, I guess it is. If someone says, your instruction for getting out of your house is you walk out the door and you go outside, I'll be like, well, which door? Maybe I can go out this other door. Or is a window a door? Can I go out the window instead? Does that count as, what do you define as door? And people get irritated at me because, like, I comprehend differently, I guess. And so I saw your thing and I said, well, I can shoot my, you know, I'll call it magic missile. I can shoot my magic missile and I can get one guy. Or I can also get one guy who might be not really in range. But if I do this and I can do a special fireball and I get a little extra range, and then why would I use the other? Because this is way cooler. And I was a little sad when you got rid of it, but I understand why.
Well, I appreciate your understanding. But yeah, no, I mean, that's just it. Like, you need to watch, and you never once said anything about it either. You just played, and it was very quick to see that it was something that needed to be addressed. And we talked about it after the fact, but I could have easily just not even said anything to you and just went and changed it. I already got my information for that.
Well, I tell you, Alex, it's been really interesting to hear you, and we've talked before about it, but to hear you talk more about how you've gone about with your process for creating the game and the hows and the whys and all of that. The background on it is fascinating. And I think one of the really cool things, one of the great takeaways, I think, for everyone, including myself, but listeners and everyone, is that we can all do this. And I know I've been guilty of, and we've said it before, you look at a set of rules and you think, well, I want to tweak this and I want to do that. And for most of us, it never gets beyond the, it would be nice if. And you've actually taken that extra step where you've said, I like how these mechanics work in these other games, and I have something that I'm passionate about. So you've taken those mechanics, you've modified them and made it your own so that you put your own stamp on what you're passionate about and been able to take it and push it out and make it available to people. And sometimes that's all it takes, and it's hard for a lot of us, but I think so many of us can do it, and I hope that more people do. And so that by hearing your story about how you've done it, that others will say, yeah, me too, I will do it, and actually go and do it so that they can find whatever makes them happy and then make it available to their gaming group and their friends and their clubs or wherever they play games and try something new and different.
Yeah, I hope so too. I thank you again for having me on and letting me kind of take your time. But I hope people do sort of enjoy my story and take it upon themselves to put stuff out there, because it's, you know, it's not up to GW and other big names to create a game. Like, I mean, people, we've been creating games since we were kids, right? All of us, whether it's some sort of ridiculous variation of tag or anything like that. Go ahead and find what makes you happy with this and make your own little story.
Well, now I'd like to move on to one of my favorite sections of the show. And anyone who's been a longtime listener knows what's coming. And if you're new, well, I think you're in for a treat. It's the mailbag section. So I love mailbag, partly because I get to hear from all of you. And people might think it's kind of crazy, but one of my favorite parts of podcasting is interacting with listeners and people who like the show or wanted to improve. And when you take the time to go from, oh, I have this thought about something, to actually writing in or sending a message, I like to hear what you have to say, and I like to share that with everyone, partly because I think it encourages all of us to think, well, so-and-so left a message on Facebook or sent a tweet or an email or whatever. I can too, in that we're listening here. We're responding. I know Mike takes a peek at what's going on online, and I always, of course, am seeing all that kind of stuff. So we have here a couple of comments from Facebook, actually, and both of them are about some of the stuff we're doing with the Extra Life charity fundraiser, which I'll get into a little bit with announcements. So I want to say, first of all, listener Dave, quote, said, these are going to fly, buddy, unquote. And he's talking about the eBay charity auction we're doing of the Last Charge of LaSalle 28mm front rank figures. These are going to be going. So by the time you listen to this, they're probably gone. But I agree with them. They're doing really well. And then listener David said of the fundraiser, quote, we'll talk it up. Can never go wrong with 24 hours of gaming, unquote. So I want to thank both David and Dave for taking the time to leave a message for us and a comment on Facebook. And you too can get in touch and leave messages and comments on Facebook. Go to wargamingrecon.com/Facebook. And that's how you can leave a comment. Obviously, if you wanted to play Alex's game and say, Alex, I really like what you're doing with here, leaving a comment on our Facebook's not going to help, but that's why you tell them directly. And we have a new iTunes review. So iTunes is really cool because a lot of people listen and find podcasts on iTunes. And one way that many of us choose what we want to hear or what we want to try is by looking at the ratings and the reviews. Just like if you're buying something on Amazon, you're buying a board game, you go to Board Game Geek, you say, what do they rate it? Is it worth it? Is it not? So we have this review here from, no, that's not it either. You would think by now, after having done the show for so many years, I would have this handy. Here we go. So we have this 5-star review titled Entertaining and Engaging by New England Grognard. I'm just going to summarize the review because it's very lengthy. But in the review, New England Grognard says, quote, the show delves into all things gaming, from reviews to what to know when attending your first game convention to gift buying guides. The host has a friendly, engaging, and humorous style that will keep you entertained for the length of the show. If you are a gamer, you want to check out Wargaming Recon, unquote. The full review will be in our show notes. And as I said, you can find those at wargamingrecon.com/WR170. And then we have some announcements. And Alex, I think some of these will be of interest to you. And I know they will be of interest to other listeners. So, of course, I want to thank the show sponsor, the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the people who put on Huzzah. Huzzah is going to be happening May 19th through the 21st of 2017 up in Portland, Maine at the Doubletree Inn. I'll be doing a live episode of the show there. And I could just go ahead and not say anything, but I have to say because it's the kind of guy I am. So anyone who listened to episode 169, especially in the first few days that it came out, will notice that I don't have my sponsor message in there. And I thought I did. And I thought I double and triple checked that. And I thought everything was in there. But it turns out there's no intro of any kind. There's no theme music. There's no nothing. It's just me saying hello and welcome to. And man, egg on my face. So that's been fixed. But I wanted people to know that hopefully it's there for this episode because I think I fixed it. And it'll be there for future episodes. But just in case, really have to go to Huzzah. And Alex, I don't know how easy it is for you guys to get away during school vacation. It's not school vacation week, is it?
No, it's not.
In May. But I think your family would love going to Huzzah. Now, I don't think necessarily your wife and your daughter would love the convention, but Portland's a great city. It's a great foodie city. A lot of things to do for families. And I'm lucky because my wife and I, we've worked it out where we go and it's kind of like a family vacation. So that we divide it in half. So half the time I get to play games and do stuff at the convention and we stay at the con. And then the other half of the time for my daughter and I, we go and we do fun stuff. We'll go to a lighthouse. We can go into the city. You can do all sorts of stuff. It's very walkable. A lot of outdoor activities you can do in that time of year. It's gorgeous. There's great food, great drinks, great everything. And I think you guys would have a lot of fun. And I think you should go and you should know that I'm going to continue to pressure you as we get closer and closer to Huzzah for May, that you should book a room and you guys should go for a summer vacation.
Very good. Noted. I will make every attempt, especially if you're going to not let up on it.
Yeah. Huzzah, and people might think I'm saying it because they're the sponsor, but it's not. There's part of the reason why they're the sponsor is because I feel this way. But Huzzah is probably one of my favorite, if not the favorite, historical wargaming conventions that I go to. They do it really well. The games are very well done. People who do it are very knowledgeable. You have a great time. There's a good variety of games, nice vendors. The hotel is fantastic. It has a great pool, which is usually enough for most people, and it's convenient to everything. So the Doubletree is right across the street from the main mall, and there's a lot of places to eat there, a lot of places to shop. And again, you go into Portland, and Portland is just, it's a beautiful city.
I do love Portland. It is nice.
So you can't go wrong. And more and more people who go are going now with their families. So it's this interesting dichotomy where there's a lot of people who are in their, say, 50s and 60s or older who obviously don't go with kids. And then there's people like our age, thereabouts, in their 30s and their 40s, who go with their families. And they make a thing of it, and their significant others are maybe hang out with the kids for a while, and they break off. And I know last year, one of the guys, I think, went, there was some sort of train museum or a thing park or something around there, I think. So they went and they got to see all the locomotives, and the kids had a great time. And just a lot of really good kid things and parks and playgrounds and just fun stuff. And it doesn't matter what your kids are into, there's something nearby that will make them happy. And so mommy or daddy, whoever the wargamer is, can go and play some games. And then you go with everyone. And it's hard to say no, except, I mean, cost, of course, because hotels aren't cheap, but it's a great hotel. And I can't say enough good reasons why people should go to Huzzah if you don't. I mean, if you live in Australia, kind of hard maybe, but even then, you plan it right, come to the States for a vacation, go to Huzzah up in Maine, they have a good time, and it's good things, I'm just saying. And then also I want to thank our Patreon backers. So Patreon is really cool because it allows listeners like you to say, yes, I like what's happening here at Wargaming Recon. I want to support Jonathan and the show, and let me go do it, and then make it easy. So I want to thank some of our backers. I want to thank Patrick, Chris Parker, Dave in the Wargames at Battleshades Facebook group, and Kyle from Vermont for their very kind and generous support. And you too can become a Patreon backer for as little as $1 a month. That's right, $1 a month. And that'll get you episodes before everyone else, because backers always get new episodes before everyone else. Might be a day or 2 days before, but you get them before it goes out to the public. And then you will also get behind the scenes content. So that might be extra audio, it might be some video or a blog post or whatever. I do a lot of extra stuff. And then you also get access to me. So if you don't belong to Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you can get direct access to me here. And I actually get a lot of show topic ideas from listeners. And I like to see what listeners and Patreon backers are saying. So I get that and kind of shovel it in. And there's other reward levels. So let's say you have $18 handy that you might like to back the show with for a month. And that's a really loud sound for people, but. And you might want to get your very own really cool set of Wargaming Recon custom wooden dice. These are made by Christopher Rett, who will be at Huzzah. And he custom made these for us. They're laser engraved and all that kind of stuff. They're gorgeous dice. And $18 gets them from my hands to yours. So I would be delighted to get them to you. And I know people are getting them and using them and love them. I love them. And we're really close to reaching our next goal. I think just $16 away. In the next goal, if we reach it, what it does is it'll allow me to be able to buy some new equipment so that I can record in person with someone, whether it's at a game day or at a convention. Or like, Alex, you live like 5 minutes down the street from me. So in some ways, it's kind of ridiculous that we're doing this through a Google Hangout when we could have just met at like a coffee shop or like at one of our houses and done it, except I don't have the equipment. So
wah, wah.
I know, right? $16 is all that stands in the way of me forcing Alex to come and record again in person without us being like 5 minutes away. I'm just saying, people, it's an option. So
that might prevent people from giving you $16. I don't think they necessarily want me back.
We don't want to hear that Alex guy. Let's unsubscribe now. You see the download count just go, wait, I only get like 1,500 people. Why is it like four people this month? I don't know. What's that all about? Maybe, but if you like what Alex is doing and you like the show, hey, $16, that's like 16 people giving up a cup of coffee or something like that. So we have that going on. And then I'm doing a huge push right now. And Alex, you know, because I won't shut up about it because we text and I'm like, Alex, did you see? And I put it on Facebook and all over the place, put the Extra Life 24-hour Gamerathon. So this is very, very important. It's one big thing we do really a year as a charity fundraiser. And I've been doing it. This is my fifth year. So if you're not familiar, Extra Life is a great charity where they take money that's raised and they distribute it out to whatever hospitals you designate, children's hospitals, so that kids who need medical treatment and can't afford it can get it. Because I don't think any kid who has cancer should be denied treatment. I don't think a kid who's suffering from anything should have to worry that mom and dad can't pay. And I can't even imagine what it's like for a parent to be like, little Tommy, little Sally has, you know, whatever, and we can't do a darn thing about it. And that, I think, is one of the worst things around. So Extra Life, really, it's important. And it's something that we can all do. So as gamers, it's very easy for us to get involved. So I'll be playing games for 24 hours. It's on November 5th. And you'll see me live streaming and tweeting and all that kind of stuff and raising money for it. You can make a donation, which is tax deductible according to law, by going to wargamingrecon.com/charity. I'm going to have a few people over who will be playing games with me. And I'm waiting to hear back from everyone, nudge, nudge, to see who is and is not able to make it.
Can I RSVP online right now?
Yeah, you can do that. Are you like, no, there. I'm not coming to your stupid thing. And
I will be there.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. And a few others. I can't fit a lot of people, which is why it's very few people who come. But I try to change it up every year so that it's different people, some listeners, some people I know, some new people, whatever. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I can say that I've set a goal this year of $250. We've met and exceeded the goal already. So we're at $275. I still have more pledges coming in from people. And as part of this, and this started a few years ago from a listener to Dave actually had this great idea where he didn't even tell me he was doing this until after the fact, which makes it even more exciting because I love this sort of community involvement. He was like, he saw that I was raising money and he thought it would be great to paint up a miniature, auction it on eBay, and then donate the proceeds. And he's a professional painter, does a fantastic job. So he did that. And then the second year, he's like, I want to do it again, but do you want to take over the auction side? I said, yeah, sure, why not? Make it more official, whatever. So now it's a third year, and it's really expanded. So we have all these eBay charity auctions that I'm going to be doing between now and the Gamerthon event. So right now, you can bid, although by the time you listen to it, I think this one's will be over, which is a shame because someone's going to get a great, great deal. But our first auction is for a 28mm Front Rank Last Charge of LaSalle figures, which I mentioned. They're professionally painted by Stuart Foley of paintedwargamefigures.co.uk. They are currently at $41 American, and I'm told they're worth like double that. So you can bid on it if you want by going to wargamingrecon.com/eBay charity auction. And like I said, it might be over by the time you listen to this episode. But we have another auction up right now too. And I'll be having more and I'll be mentioning them on social media. So make sure you follow on Facebook and on Twitter. But the second one is for a really cool out of print card game. It's James Clavell's Shogun based off of the TV miniseries. It was award winning and based off the book, one of my favorite books of all time. We should talk about it sometime because I tell you, I've read it more times than anyone probably should ever read this thing. It's almost memorized, and it's mesmerizing. It's a bluffing betting game. It's for like three to six players, something like that. It has a rating of 6.1 on BoardGameGeek. It was donated by my co-host, Mike Payne. It's currently at $8.50 on eBay. You can bid for it at wargamingrecon.com/charity auction 2. Don't worry, I'm going to have the links in the show notes because I know it's a lot of stuff. wargamingrecon.com/WR170 will be the show notes. And you can just click on the links in that to get to these things. In this game, it's out of print. You can't find it anywhere. I've looked actually for a while, for a couple of years, because Mike Payne once told me about it. And as a huge Shogun fan, I thought, oh, maybe I'll try to see if I can get a copy online and look it up. And it's nowhere. But I believe it's worth like $20 to $30 at least. So someone, again, is going to get a steal. Should know that all the auctions that I'll be doing for the eBay charity stuff will be starting at 99 cents American. And the idea and the hope is that the 99 cents will draw people in and there'll be a lot of bids going and that people will bid generously because all the proceeds from these auctions will then go right into the fundraiser. So it's all going to go to help the kids and we're just going to see what we can do. And as you can tell, if you're doing some simple math, $41 for the trio of figures, $8.50 for this, plus whatever other stuff I have, which is like 6 or 7 more auctions I'm going to be doing, I think we're going to raise quite a bit of money for this. So I'm hoping that we can do a lot of good. And one of my goals, Joe here, and Alex, I know you talked about some of your goals for your game about making it quick and easy and fewer figures and things like that. One of my goals for the show is that whatever sort of soapbox I have here, I want to use it for good. I want to make the world a little bit better than it was when I came in. And that's what I think we can do here with the Extra Life charity auctions and the Extra Life Gameathon and all that kind of stuff. So this is, you know, it's a big thing we do here. Other shows do other things. They fund for Wood Warrior Project or Henry Hyde, as people probably know, does his battle games appeal, the combat stress appeal for soldiers and sailors in the UK and service people who are suffering from what we call here PTSD, but combat stress. And he does a lot of good there with that. And so this is what we do here at Wargaming Recon, trying to help the kids with the diseases so they can get some treatment. So maybe they won't have the diseases anymore and they can just be normal kids. And Alex, I know you and I are blessed with having children who are healthy and happy, and not everyone is, and just like to give back. So that's what we're doing. And what else do we have for you? We have a reminder, because not everyone knows, you can check out our episode guide to see what's coming up. And that's how, if you had checked the other day, you could have saw that Alex was coming on today to talk about crafting a homebrew game. And next episode, we're going to be talking about the Fort Devens Museum Game Day. And we got a holiday gift guide coming, an Extra Life episode, and all that kind of stuff. It's in the episode guide, people. And I think that's all I have for everyone. So don't forget, next episode, November 7th, is when it comes out to the public. Before that, for Patreon backers, if you don't want to wait, become a backer. wargamingrecon.com/Patreon. Nice and easy, right? So, Alex, thank you again, first of all, for coming on the show and talking and for sitting through paying the bills, because it's important.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
People, and maybe you too, I don't know, people may not realize that it's expensive doing this. It's not just like sit in front of your computer and talk. Well, I mean, it is. But like, you got to get the computer, you got to get the stuff you talk into, you got to have guests who come on, and you got to have like things to talk about. And
you need that, you know, that star looking microphone you got there.
Well, yeah. So anyone who watches live or watches the YouTube videos, you can see I have this microphone. And it's not the best microphone in the world. It's a Blue Snowball mic. So I like it partly because of the name, because I love snow and winter. I'm a December baby, sue me. But also because it has that really cool old style mic feel to it. You put it in this thing, it's called a shock mount, so that if I bang on the table, you're not going to hear the vibrations. So it's kind of like when you package stuff and you get something from Amazon, it has all those airbags around it. It's kind of like the same thing, but it makes it look, I don't know, weird. And I like it, so it appears in video. But when you listen to the show, you don't get that. You just get to hear my wonderful silky voice, right? But the stuff's expensive. It being an independent outfit, not being like the official Games Workshop podcast or something like that, means that when I review something, like, I gotta buy it. And that's cool, I don't mind, but like, money doesn't grow on trees, as my dad used to tell me. And so I love that the show is becoming more and more revenue neutral, where between sponsorships and listeners, that's paying for stuff, so that like, I'm not able to fund the show completely anymore. And like, I tell you, I did some math the other day, and this shocked me, and it's probably going to shock everyone else. It takes like about $1,000 a year to keep the show going. And I was like, what? I'm just talking into a mic. But like, between going to conventions and covering them and covering events and getting games and all that kind of stuff and sending out rewards or whatever, that's a lot of money. So just think, Alex, how much production you could put into your game and getting people doing graphic design for it and layout and all that kind of stuff for $1,000.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that's the show. Thank you again. I really, really, really appreciate that you were able to take the time to come on. I know you're a busy guy, and this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you very much.
Awesome. So everyone, you know the deal. You know that no matter how busy you are, no matter how much you need to play test your own homebrew game or play Alex's, that you need to keep on gaming.
Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon and all of the other podcasts that you know and love. Or you can always stream and download the latest episode of Wargaming Recon by heading on over to the show notes for that episode. Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the TSR Podcast Network. Visit wargamingrecon.com/TSRPN for more information and to learn about the other great shows on the network.
This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.
Wargaming Recon is dedicated to the memory of longtime listener Andrew, who helped give the show its name. I ask all listeners to join me in a moment of silence in memory of Andrew. Wargaming Recon is made possible by listeners like you. Become a Patreon backer to get behind-the-scenes content and new episodes before everyone else, starting at $1 per month. Visit wargamingrecon.com/Patreon to become a Patreon backer. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah will take place May 19th through the 21st, 2017 at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information.